Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. My guest today is Richard Knight Jr., film critic at Windy City Times, whose new film, Scrooge and Marley, premiered earlier this month at the Music Box Theater and will soon be screening at the Gene Siskel Film Center starting December 21st. So, Richard, thank you so much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Oh, totally. Well, this is the sort of film, Scrooge and Marley, this is the film I have to see. I'm going to be the first person in line for it because I have to see every single cinematic adaptation of A Christmas Carol. It's just one of those timeless stories that is just inherently, you can basically attach it to any era, any generation, any demographic, and it still rings true. And I mean, I've seen it from the best ones all the way down to the worst ones, and I just always enjoy seeing the new versions of this
thing. You've seen the doggy Christmas Carol?
Because I may have seen the doggy one, yeah.
Yeah. Susan Lucci.
Oh, God.
Vanessa Williams has played Scrooge. I mean, it's kind of, you know, they've sort of done every version that could be possible except for a gay one. And we thought, boy, that's a, that might apply to our community. So that's kind of where the idea came from.
Oh, totally. Well, what were the certain, like, Christmas carols that you grew up? It seems like everyone kind of grew up with one. Like my parents, they each were watching different channels as a kid growing up. So one of them grew up with Reginald Owen and the other one grew up with Alastair Sim. And, like, people kind of have, like, those that they watched.
I would say, actually, the one that I love the most is very obscure, and it actually won the Oscar for Short Subject. It's an animated version that I first saw on television. I think it was on CBS. And Chuck Jones executive produced it, and a guy, I want to say his name is Richard Williams. It's, like, from 1971. It's 22 minutes. It's astounding. You actually can see it online because they never released it on DVD. But they actually got Alastair Sim and Ralph Richardson.
Oh, that's right. I heard about that, that Sim reprises his role.
And they literally, it's so beautifully drawn. The drawings are inspired by the original illustrator, the Dickens novel. And in 22 minutes, they really get to the essence of the story. And they get everything in, which is astounding. So that's the one that I saw kind of, I wasn't really a child, you know, because I'm sort of a little bit older than I appear to be.
Sure.
Like 15 years. But that one has always stayed with me. Of course, I love the Alastair Sim every year.
We have to
do that one, too. And I like little bits and pieces of every other one. You know, the original one, that's MGM, 1938. So it's the height of the studio, you know, the Hollywood, the Dream Factory. Yes. So it's, you know, the lighting, the sets, you know, it's Gene Lockhart.
There's a real warmth to the Cratchit family in that film that I feel I don't see in some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the strength of that. But, yeah, the Sim performance, everyone kind of looks to that as, like, the gold standard because there's just so much depth to that. And when he has that final, his arc is so extreme. When he has that awakening at the end, it's so much more exhilarating.
Right. He's so, I mean, I also love Albert Finney, the musical version, Scrooge, which I'd sort of seen but not really focused on. And then there's a gay film critic named Alonzo Duralde who wrote a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas a couple years ago. So anybody who likes Christmas movies, get this book.
Yeah.
And he goes through, like, you know, every single version of A Christmas Carol. And he really, that's his favorite. So I went back and watched it again. Of course, it's on TCM every year.
Oh, nice.
It's tremendous. Hmm. And Finney is really mean. He's mean. And that's probably the one thing about Alastair Sim. He's mean, but he ain't that mean.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, and that's one thing I really told David Pesner, who played our Scrooge. I was like, I want you mean as hell. I want the audience to hate you. And he was very nervous
he
about
is,
it.
He is, and he is in the film. He's pretty
mean.
Intense. Yeah.
You know, he's like, oh, man, I'm really chewing up the scenery. And I was like, it's A Christmas Carol. It's a melodrama. I want you to chew the scenery. That's your job. Trust me.
And even though Scrooge, the Finney musical you're talking about, is indeed a musical, it goes to an even darker place in the climax than a lot of the other ones. It goes all the way down to, like, Dante's Inferno, and then you have that great, like, a reprise of, you know, Alec Guinness coming back.
Exactly.
So it's kind of a nice thing. I mean, and actually, just the whole idea of music, you know, set to Dickens, I think that's a hard thing to pull off. I think that's hard to sort of, you know, sort of get into sort of like the integral, like, rhythm of the movie. Like where are we putting the music? What part of that? I mean, I guess on one end, you know, the holidays just naturally scream music. But it's like, how do you allow the music to sort of advance the narrative? And I think in Scrooge and Marley, it's very integral to even just the setting. It's so you sort of solve that problem by making kind of the theatricality of a musical number so integral to the setting itself.
Well, I'm actually, that's my background is music. I was a singer-songwriter for years. I've had bands for years. And the theme of the picture is a song called Christmas Eve is Coming Soon, which I actually wrote 13 years ago. Mm. I mean, I love what I call haunted Christmas music, stuff like Oh Holy Night, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, those kinds of things. And so right from the get-go, when we finished the first draft, I knew that that song was going to be part of the movie. And it just made sense, like, if we put it in a cabaret, then we can do some musical numbers. After we go into the past and you see this terrible, you know, his past is so dreadful, we got to lighten it up. We really need to lighten it up, which is why the idea for the kind of Christmas Broadway show-stopping thing. And then the other song, I think the other big song is Rusty Schwimmer sings the song.
Yes, that's right.
Who plays Frida, Scrooge's niece in our version. And I've known Rusty for 27 years. And, you know, she spent 24 years in Hollywood doing all these different kinds of pictures, Little Princess, Perfect Storm, mm-hmm. you know, Louis C.K. last year, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
she's in
that's
the sessions.
Right. Oh, she was so great on Louis. Yeah,
so
she
great.
Was great. Yeah.
And, but she's never really sung in a movie. And I have known forever that she has this kick-ass voice. Can I say ass?
Oh, sure. Yes.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay. This kick-ass voice that, and I was determined we were going to write a song for her. And so there, you know, that's kind of how that song came in. So we kind of wedged that one in. But it, you know, she rates it, I think. So
yes, and I believe you have a cameo. If I did see correctly somewhere in there, you might be behind a piano.
I have an alter ego named Dick O'Day,
I
play this character forever,
yeah.
a long time, and had a cabaret act with Becca Kaufman, who's in the film and plays the cabaret singer, and you know it's. It was much easier for me to do it because
yes.
I work for free.
Sure.
You know, we've done it forever. I knew I wanted Becca in the film because I love her singing. She's from musical theater, very natural. I knew she'd be great. And I wanted her to sing the song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted her to sing my song. And I think all those things sort of worked in that cabaret setting.
Yeah, and Dick O'Day is such a perfect fit for that, just the whole
well,
section.
Well, I dialed him way down.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But just as a film critic, film scholar, were there certain things that you've seen in other interpretations? Because there's just endless interpretations. I mean, I'm a fan of the Muppet Christmas Carol, Mr. Magoo's
Marlene,
Christmas Carol. Actually, when I saw the Goodman Christmas Carol many years ago, which was a wonderful, I think it was the last time Tom Mueller played the lead role. It was a wonderful production. There was a parent and his son sitting right behind me going, no, son, I just want to let you know, in this version, there's only one Marley. So it just shows the endless influence
right.
of the Muppets. But was there certain things in some of these adaptations you've seen that you wanted to particularly avoid? Certain mistakes you've seen other people made? Certain things you wanted to emulate a bit more? Or certain strengths and weaknesses you've seen in just from the script to screen?
I would say the main thing we wanted to avoid was make him nice. Mm. Or too nice or too easy. That's why I said earlier, I really wanted to mean. Mm-hmm. So this redemption, when it happens, you really believe it. Also, I wanted to create a much more detailed backstory so you understand how he became so horrible,
mm-hmm.
so loveless. And at the end, and this was much later, actually, I want to say we were getting close to production, and I sort of thought, you know, this epiphany that happens, he wakes up Christmas morning, you know, there's not really an 11 o'clock number there. You know,
and no,
okay,
sure,
yay,
sure.
It was great. And I wanted to have some kind of callback thing mm-hmm. emotionally for mm-hmm. the audience, which is why we put in the whole part about the letter.
Yes.
Which is, I don't know how much you want to go into this, but...
Sure. But there's a certain tie-in to his past that links to that crucial moment, which it is. And sometimes it's just like flipping a light switch. Oh, everything's better. Oh, I'm going to... Because then it just makes it seem like it's more like, oh, I'm alive. Oh, good. Now I'm only acting good out of the fear of death. And there's a little bit more to it than that in this version.
Yeah, so I just felt like I wanted to flesh things out more.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be more specific about how he went about changing lives and his own life that you really saw that, okay, now he's ready to experience love again himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun to play with that kind of stuff. The whole opening thing that we did with Purgatory and showing, you know, Marley in Purgatory, like, you know, deciding he needs to go back. And,
yeah,
you know, so it's like being in a candy store, like, ooh, that I've never seen that before. I think the original, the Alistair Sim version is the one in which they, young Scrooge and Marley take Fezziwig. And I don't know that I've seen that in other versions.
Yes.
I don't believe that's in the Dickens book. And I loved that.
Yes.
That worked really, really well.
Yes, exactly. Because I think there's even a shot of one of the most heartbreaking shots in the sim version is Fezziwig looking up at his store, just get the sign being taken
right.
down or something. You get a little bit of that. And you really do elaborate on that whole concept.
Well, it's so tragic. And I'm of an age, you know, that I went to discos when I was a young guy in the 70s. And you saw these Alan Carr type flamboyant, you know, guys walking around their caftans who were the life of the party and, mm-hmm. you know, drinks for everybody as long as there were beautiful boys and drugs around. You could take advantage of these open-hearted guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, this kind of works. And so at any rate,
yeah,
those were some things.
Yeah. Well, I think two of the best performances in the film are the young Scrooge and his boyfriend at that time, too,
because that does kind of
form like the heart of the whole of really what that inner conflict is and that inner sort of hurt that he has in him.
Well, those are two young, tremendous actors. First of all, a huge shout out to our casting director, Heather Schmucker, who knows the theater community here in and out and put such great people in front of me. You have to understand, I had never done this before. Talk about it. Sure, I'll make a movie. Why
sure.
not? I can do it. No problem. I made a short film in college in 1977, so why not?
There you go. You know? Something, you know?
But, it's like logically, okay, I guess I better have a good script. I better have really good actors and somebody who knows how to shoot the thing. And blah, blah, you know, so it's, you know. It's not exactly rocket science, maybe a little bit. So she brought Drew Anderson, who plays young Scrooge, brought him in, Christopher Allen, who plays young Bill's boyfriend. And I'm not kidding, those guys, anything you ask them to do, and they read different roles and tried different things. And, you know, and this was a ultra low budget shoot, no time for rehearsals, not a lot of that kind of stuff. So they had to come to the set prepared, and they really, really did. I mean, we would, you know, do blocking rehearsals and, you know, I want a little bit more, a little bit less, that kind of thing. I don't know. I can't say enough about them. They emotionally were prepared to go as far as we asked them to. That breakup scene between the two of them, mm-hmm. that was shot, like, I think maybe the third day. And, you know, of course, every gay man in the blue. It wasn't just a gay man. It's like anybody who's been through a breakup
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
It's wrenching.
Yes. These universal issues, which is really what's so interesting about this film is that it really kind of sticks to the Dickens story quite well. And it's just the simple fact that we're seeing, you know, a gay Scrooge rather than a straight, you know, Scrooge, but barely really changing a lot of just the integral themes of the book. It just shows just how universal this subject matter is, that it can really, you know, apply to anything. And I could see so many viewers watching this, you know, regardless of the thing. Oh, I don't know if I'd want to see, you know, a gay Christmas Carol. Just kind of just getting right into it as they would any sort of adaptation.
Well, that's certainly our hope. And that's why we gave it the tagline, a holiday film for all of us. You know, and we certainly have heard that from audiences. Of course, there's people resistant. You know, oh, how dare you touch Scrooge, and you know, how dare you touch Dickens, and oh, don't you gays have enough?
Sure.
No, we don't have enough. We want more. But no, absolutely, I think this is something that everybody can take something from, sure.
Yeah, and as you know, someone who's making like your first, you would say this is your first feature, this is your first like feature effort, you know.
Yes.
Working with a co-director, I think it was Peter Neville was your co-director.
Yes,
on this.
Yes.
What was that collaboration like? Was this also his first feature that he was working on?
Yes, actually, I've worked with Peter on, you know, music video projects, a lot of different projects, over a 20-year period. And again, I knew, okay, I'm sort of out of my element here. So I better bring in somebody technically who knows kind of what they're doing. And you know, Peter's a great editor. He knows a lot about that tech side. So I was able to work with actors, which I knew was going to be one of my strengths, mm-hmm. and work on the visual and work on the music and with the set, you know, all that kind of stuff. It was great. We sort of, you know, he called action and I called cut. And I think the best time for he and I was in the editing room, because mm-hmm. that's what we're used to.
Sure.
You know, playing off each other.
Yeah. Well, and I've always thought actually editing is one of my personal favorite parts of the whole production process, post-production, I mean, or just any film production in general, because I feel like editing just works on the same part of your brain as writing does. It's just taking all this raw footage and assembling it, and that must have been a painstaking process in terms of this
Well,
project.
Also because we were on an insane timeline under the gun to shoot this in May and then have it out now by the holidays. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was sort of crazy, and all of that really is attributable to our executive producer, Tracy Bain, who is, I call her, the human dynamo. She's like a little Tasmanian devil. When she says she's going to do something, she gets it done. And it's astonishing to me. I turned to my husband at the music box opening and said, how did we get here? We were shooting this in May, and here it is December, and the movie is done, and it's on a DVD and Blu-ray and blah, blah, blah. So it was just literally every day you have that list of 500 things and you start crossing them off.
Sure.
And
yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, and that's what's one thing that's so wonderful about Chicago. There's all these great indie venues that will really allow you that level of exposure, even so close after the film is done, to kind of like have, you know, it really gives a lot of these independent filmmakers a great place to kind of try out their work and everything.
Oh, so. Well, I have to immediately give a shout out to Columbia College, because that's where all of this stuff spanned from. Ellen Stone King, our lead screenwriter, was very close friends with a woman named Lynn Pustai, who I also know, who's head of the intern film program at Columbia, who led us to Tavri Crouch, our line producer, which led us down. I mean, endlessly people stepped up and said, I love what you're doing. Can I help you?
Yeah.
Can I offer my venue? Can I offer the support? Can I pay for something? I mean, because, you know, that's how this stuff happens. It's well, I didn't know it, but now.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah.
And then with a lot of experience, having done so many different things myself, then I was able to call somebody and say, boy, I really need a great logo. I can't afford you, but, you know, we've known each other for a long time. So, Michael Carr, please, can you do a logo for, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You draw on those relationships, which certainly helped a lot.
Well, and you mentioned the casting process of this. I think one of the reasons why I think a lot of people should really check this out, you know, a lot of especially independent filmmakers, is just the large pool of talent that you draw from in this. A lot of it's just amazing local talent in the casting process. How did you come upon the lead actor? Was it David Pevsner, right, for the role of Scrooge?
He submitted a video to us. He's an L.A.-based actor who actually grew up, I want to say, in Skokie. I think, or now Lincolnshire or something. And we had a lot of local actors that we looked at and some other people on tape from New York and that sort of thing. And this came in and was like, oh, boy, this would be kind of a different way to go, but he's really good and he's out. I love that. Mm. And he's got this great resume. And it was just like, oh, we've got to get him in the room, though. We've got to get him in the room. And he came in and knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, that's our Scrooge. That's it.
Yeah. And really, it goes back to that theme of family. Why family in particular is kind of the sticking point for Scrooge, and what it really is kind of spawns a lot of his bitterness. And I think that's one thing that this film does very well and his performance does well, is kind of take it all back to that sense of family. And there's some very pointed lines that Scrooge has in the various flashbacks and things where it's like, well, you know, why would family be important to me? Family was just something that, you know, abandoned me, you know, at a young age and when I needed it most. And I thought that was a very interesting thing to kind of enhance.
Well, again, so many gay men and women of my age, I'm 55, experience this. You know, we're kicked out of their house. They're still being kicked out. When we were in post-production, all of a sudden, what was the big headline in Huffington Post gave voices? You know, this man, a father, kicks his son out, and here's the letter, you know, that he sent. I mean, this is still going on. And that, I don't care, that scars you. So what did we do? I didn't experience this, but a lot of my friends did. You create a new family. You create your own family when you're ostracized, that kind of thing. And so it certainly resonated, I think, and will with a lot of people, not just gay people.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, and this, you might also just be like too close to the material to even look at it in this kind of overarching view. But just where do you see Scrooge and Marley kind of fitting into just kind of like the queer cinema scene at the moment? Do you see this as kind of a film very much of its time, or certain that this was the right time to make this movie, or is this all very kind of circumstantial how it came together?
Well, a little of all of that. Mm. A little of all of that. I think that it feels a little bit of a niche that there are not a lot of gay themed holiday films, and we need more. And, you know, selfishly, that's what I wanted. I'm a huge Christmas movie junkie. I watch them every year with my husband, and I think I've talked about the inspiration for this was probably The Family Stone.
Oh,
the Thomas Bazooka 2005 film, which has a major gay character in the family, and it's not like he's this, you know, there's no coming out. He's just out, and he has an African-American partner, and they're talking about adopting a child, and he's, you know.
And they have all sorts of problems. I remember in that film where they almost like the laundry list of problems, yet they're the most kind of normal, centered, grounded people in the family.
Exactly,
sort of thing,
and they're kind of the normal. And at the end of the film, every year it's like, oh, I want the whole movie to be from their point of view or to see their story. So it was kind of that I wanted to see a whole movie told from our point of view, and I just wanted a movie that I could go back to every year.
Yeah.
And then also just sort of shows that, queer people have celebrated holiday traditions all this time. Just because you're not aware of it, we have Christmas trees and we have Hanukkah menorahs and all that kind of stuff too. So there's that. And I think, politically, culturally, the time is on our side. Mm-hmm. That this may seem shocking and horrible to some people. How dare you clutch my pearls? but come on. You see which way the country is going. That, next year, next year, next year. The thing that I also love about this is that unlike a lot of queer cinema, this is going to come back every single year. Like that Carpenter's Holiday album, you're never going to get rid of us. We are coming back every single year.
It's positioned to be a perennial in that sense. Yeah, definitely. Mm. I can't do a podcast without at least asking a little bit about Bruce Valanche as Fezziwig. And then also Alison Torrum as, I think, was it Fan? Is it Fan?
It's Franny. She plays Franny in our version.
Franny,
but
and that's the sister.
That's Scrooge's sister. That's the tragic sister.
Who I just have nothing but just the highest. I feel so, like, there's so much potential when I look at her. I just see, like, there's such great things for her. And I feel like because she was in a film called The Wise Kids by Stephen Cohen, which is one of my favorite films.
Can't say enough about it.
Seen in recent years. And she was the perfect choice for that role in Scrooge and Marley because you need someone to break your heart in the few scenes that she has. And I felt like that really, worked out well for the movie.
A lot of the actors that Heather put in front of us did that. There were, she came in and, we saw maybe three or four other actors who were also very good. But, Allison came in and read it and was like, we're done. She's it. She got to the essence of that character, and she was warm and tender, and I just, that was it. And when we got on the set, again, we didn't have a lot of time, and I knew this, so I created this very elaborate backstory for the actors, like this 16-page thing of here's the timeline, here's the relationships. There's this whole thing with she and her brother where the mother has died of cancer and the father is bitter, and I don't know if you see it, but there are pictures of the family behind him. Behind him is the picture of he and his wife. Yeah. Behind her is the picture of the mother and the brother. So there's all this kind of stuff that I tried to do because I knew we wouldn't have a lot of time. And basically told her, okay, you're kind of like the stoner daughter. It's in the 70s, And you're sitting there with your father who's looking at the Mitch Miller record. You cannot wait to sneak out and go see your boyfriend. And you know what your brother's up to.
And you can see that in her eyes, just the way she looks at the guy who's bringing it.
You kind of know what he's up to. And so when this, when the father catches him and kicks him out, I don't know, I love actors. How do you get to that hysteria? And she did that over and over and over. They have some kind of trick that, and she had these, they get to that place somehow. And it was really great with Allison because she was hysterical, then she would laugh. Mm-hmm. To keep that level going. So, she really, really made her mark in those couple of scenes. And, Bruce Valanche, everybody knows that he's, hilarious and funny and, with the quips and so sharp. Mm-hmm. 23 years of writing the Oscars. And
Which is why Fezziwig's a perfect role for him, because he is supposed to be that larger-than-life personality.
Totally.
He always has a quip
totally.
For every moment,
And I told Bruce, I said, your inspiration, of course, is Alan Carr, who he knew very well and actually sort of mentored him a little bit. And Alan Carr was this larger-than-life figure who produced Grease and La Cage aux Folles and Can't Stop the Music.
Nice.
And the infamous Oscars with Rob Lowe and Snow White. And he was this guy who was the life of the party and wore the caftans and all this sort of stuff in the 70s. But I also kind of thought, you know, having known Bruce a little bit, he could do this sort of deep thing. He could go to that kind of tragic place because he's seen it, and I'm sure he's experienced it. And without hesitation, he did it. And I love that, you know, we're getting to show people, actors do something that you haven't seen before. And mm-hmm. you've never seen Bruce Valanche do something like this on film anywhere, where he's very serious and kind of a tragic figure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And, well, I'm thinking it's probably one experience seeing this film on video. And this is true for any film, really. But just seeing it on video, and I watched it on video and enjoyed it. But seeing it in an audience, I'm sure, is a different sort of experience. I'm wondering what that was like, that experience of seeing it at the Music Box for the first time with an
audience.
Well,
I got up at the end of it because it was, you know, a full house. And, you know, it's the best audience you'll ever have. And I said, I want everybody to make a film just so you can experience what I'm experiencing right now. It's surreal. Mm-hmm. I can't even begin to describe it, the amount of love and warmth. And, you know, and it was gay people, straight people, young, old. It's a subsequent screening with Tim Kazurinsky. This woman stood up and said, you know, I can't wait to buy this for my family. And I was like, oh, thank you, Aunt Helen. I mean, I was kidding. I don't know who you are. Then this other woman stood up and she was like, and I'm going to get this for it. And I was like, Grandma, you're out of the hospital. I mean, it was like, I don't even know you. How can you be saying this about our movie? You can't even describe how wonderful that is. And it also, you know, critically, we've had some great reviews. We'd have some horrible reviews. Yeah. And you realize this is an audience kind of traditional, old-fashioned movie that was made for audiences. And,
yes.
And
yeah.
So it was something that I don't know that I'll ever... It's, of course, one of the highlights of your life.
Absolutely. So. Could you see yourself doing this again? After this experience, could you see yourself directing something else, doing something else film-wise?
Oh, yes. Ellen and I are working on our next script.
Oh, nice. Very cool.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'll look forward to that. Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely.
Delightful.
I definitely want people to check this out when it screens at the Gene Siskel Film Center. And you can, for tickets and showtimes, you can visit siskelfilmcenter.org. And you can also purchase this film, Richard just told me, at scroogeandmarleymovie.com. You can purchase it as a Blu-ray DVD, and you can also view
Watch it now.
Yeah. Right on the site. Awesome. Very cool. And for all my recent reviews and interviews, you can check out hollywoodchicago.com and indie-outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.